In 1981, Muhammad Ali saved a man from committing suicide. For about 35 years, that's been the reporting. End of story. But after 3 years of talking to eyewitnesses, the LAPD, biographers, and a lone photographer, I think the chapter on this epic Ali miracle is just beginning.
Everybody, Dwayne Johnson here to tell you about a new documentary podcast series titled What Really Happened, narrated by award-winning documentary filmmaker Andrew Jenks in coordination with our company, 7 Bucks Productions.
Ali talked Joseph down, but is there more to it? Was Joseph in on it? Was Ali showing the world that he could still talk, much less box? Why did Ali's people say Joseph was a Vietnam vet when in fact he wasn't? Go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your shows to listen to What Really Happened. Available now.
Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson duel in an instant classic. The Steelers and Lions in a Sunday night bruiser. The Falcons show signs of life. A really dumb return man, a really nasty injury, and a breakdown of that aggressive Jaguars trade. All of that on the MMQB 10 Things podcast. Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. And while a lot of you nerds were watching the World Series, or maybe before that, watching the World Series pregame, thinking about the World Series, basically not watching as much football as you should have, there were some really good games, especially late afternoon and Sunday night.
And you know what I like about this week, Gary, is you get the little Halloween graphics on the scoreboard things or going
nice.
In and out of commercial. I've always loved that kind of thing. And my football room here at our house is loaded with Halloween decorations. And then come Wednesday, the day after Halloween, we're going to overdo Thanksgiving decorations.
Yeah, Thanksgiving decorations are never much fun, though. Thanksgiving itself
well, no,
is
I mean,
fun.
It's, they're stoic. They're stoic. I've got a lot of just pilgrims and Native Americans standing there straight up. But that's what it is. That's the holiday. I have an owl. Stuffed owl.
Stoic and sterile. And yeah, those are the ones. Yeah, so you have the stuffed owl for Halloween?
No, that's part of the Thanksgiving.
Wait, for Thanksgiving? Why a stuffed owl?
It's friendly. I don't know. Okay. I have a crow for Halloween. I'm looking at it right now. It's next to our candelabra.
Well, I was gonna say we have crows, or black crows, not the band, but the animal, and then we have a like giant black owl. Like it's actually kind of terrifying. It scares my kids, but that's our decor. It's nice
for Thanksgiving or for Halloween.
Halloween.
Not year round or anything. Okay, good.
Yeah. No. All right, let's jump into football now.
Number one.
Topic one. This is the Texans-Seahawks game. I'm going to say it's the game of the year so far. I mean, obviously, we're only through 8 weeks. There could be better games. I feel good about that because if you're a casual fan and you watch this game, you are exceedingly entertained. And if you are more of a connoisseur, I think there was still enough going on here to make you really excited and really into it. But we're talking, of course, about the Texans and Seahawks, the duel between Russell Wilson and Deshaun Watson. This was, I mean, if we were talking about this 6 weeks ago, we would have said, oh, defensive battle coming up. It was nothing of the sort. It looked like a Big 12 football game, the way the teams were going up and down. I want to start with the Seahawks, because the Seahawks gave up 38 points in this game. They, let's see, their running backs combined, this is Eddie Lacy and Thomas Rawls, 12 carries, -1 yards. This was pretty much all Russell Wilson, and it was all very, I mean, it was very Russell Wilson-y. It was a lot of extended plays. It was a lot of deep throws. How do you feel about this one, Andy?
Yeah, and he's been doing that a lot lately. That's what he did in the Giants game, too, last week. And I go back, you know, I think our listeners know, we go back and forth on how we feel about Russell Wilson extending plays because there's such a lack of rhythm to it at times. I haven't felt that watching these last couple of weeks. I feel like there has been a rhythm to the way he's extended plays. You know what it is, Gary? He's extending plays within the structure of the play right now versus just breaking them down, turning his back and running amok, which he's still very good at times when he does that. But you get no down-to-down consistency that way. And I'm not about to espouse down-to-down consistency for an offense that can't run the ball at all like this, but there feels like there's a consistency to what Russell Wilson is doing. And you're still seeing the passing concepts be maintained when he extends the plays. And I thought today, frankly, at times, the Texans made it easy on him. That Texan secondary is getting run through right now. They've had some injuries.
It's not a good unit right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've got Marcus Gilchrist moonlighting in there. They didn't know he'd be part of the thing. They did get Kevin Johnson back in this game, but overall, the cornerbacks have not played great. It's the first game since week one that all three have been healthy. And I thought what Seattle did, they did a really good job of getting wide receivers matched up on safeties with Houston. And Houston plays a lot of quarters coverage. And when you do that, if you align wide receivers inside, you can get those receivers matched up against the safeties, the inside quarters players. So my guess is, without having seen the all 22, I bet there were a lot of samples of that. Especially, that's why we saw so many first down passes. You get predictable looks on first down. Houston probably had some split safety stuff that Seattle was comfortable with. Clearly, the Seahawks were in the driver's seat on this one, though. And it got to where at the end of the game, it was almost like a Madden game. Just drop back and throw your deepest pass on every play.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, that late interception was sort of so jarring. It was very nicely played by Marcus Williams out there. He ran the route for I can't remember if it was Lockett or Richardson on the left sideline there, but it was kind of like, if it wasn't a turnover, you know, they weren't going to be stopped.
Yeah, and it was Richardson on that. It was an I formation pass that they did. Seattle has run the ball a lot, or at least I think it was 8 times, but it felt like more out of I formation against the Giants last week. And then they came in, they had a play action pass out of the I formation in this game. They got it to the fullback Trey Madden for that long gain. Great job of building offense. But on that play, the one you're talking about, Williams absolutely knew the route, or he had to have known the route. And there's another guy, by the way, who's playing. They didn't know he'd be a factor. He was a cornerback on the Jets. They got rid of him. He'd been inconsistent. And now here he is playing a big role for the Texans. And it worked out for him on that play. But that's emblematic of a team that's in flux with its personnel. And oh, by the way, their two best pass rushers are out for the season. And they're having to rely on just Jadeveon Clowney. And he almost won the game for him today still. Yeah. He was pretty productive.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, the only thing I'll mention, and I'll kind of transition to Watson here. Right before the Williams interception, there's actually a Russell Wilson scramble for 21 yards where it kind of looked like a clip out of that Nike commercial he does where, you know, he's just sort of running through guys and guys are like, defenders are bonking into each other in his wake and stuff like that. And he made 21 yards out of a play that looked completely dead, and he did it by sort of running in circles in the backfield for a little bit and then taking off. And you start to just kind of say, well, this is what Russell Wilson can do, and it's nice to have when you really can't generate anything else on offense. And they couldn't today. They had nothing in the run game, and this was one where Wilson had to take over. And I don't know. Is this something you can rely on consistently, especially once you get to January? That's another question, I guess, and hopefully their defense will just be much better than it was today at that point.
Yeah, and we've seen them do it before, but not without the running game. You need some semblance of a run game. This has not been the same team since Marshawn Lynch, which it was years ago now, where he became a non-factor in the offense and was eventually out of the picture altogether. They have not been the same kind of offense. We've seen a lot of inconsistencies. Now, their highs can be very high, though. That's the Russell Wilson playmaking effect. He's more likely to run the ball late in close games, too, by the way, Gary. I think, in fact, if last time I had my guys check on this, we went and we looked at every one of his runs. I think 23% of them come in what you would call a close game in the fourth quarter. He is a more aggressive runner late in the game.
Yep. Well, that brings us to Deshaun Watson, who pretty much matched him play for play throughout this one. And look, it was a big question. Watson going on the road to Seattle. Certainly the Texans had some stuff going on off the field this week? And, you know, were they just going to – was this going to be the week where Watson was not going to be up for the task? And he was. And as usual, you sort of got 10 great plays and one bad play, I guess, was the ratio. Probably had about 20 great plays today and two really bad plays that ended up costing them quite a bit. But when you're a rookie, that's just kind of how it goes. He had one play that I absolutely loved, and it was, I think it was a 3rd and 14. Let me just pull it up here. It was a 3rd and 14, and he scrambled right. And it was one of those things, they had eyes on him. And it was kind of like, well, you're not going to get 14 yards here. And he directed a blocker. And he got exactly 14 yards. And it's just kind of like, it's a sign of he's just able to calibrate as a playmaker so accurately and so well when he's out on the field. Just to be able to do something like that, especially as a rookie, is pretty mind-blowing.
He might be a better runner than Russell Wilson, at least a more gifted runner. He is a long strider. There's a fluidity to how he moves. He glides around out there, and I still believe he's not using the running as a crutch, which Wilson at this point in his career, when Wilson was a rookie, he very much was using the running as a crutch. He wasn't reading the field the way Watson's attempting to. Now, Watson doesn't always read the field correctly. We know that. We saw that. It cost him 2 interceptions in this game. Earl Thomas got him on a two-man play where a veteran would easily have read Thomas as a free defender there. And then Richard Sherman had the interception on a zone play where a veteran would have recognized that Sherman's zone was in contention against that tight end crossing route. So, yes, rookie plays by Watson, but he's attempting to play like a veteran, and we're seeing him do so successfully at times. He throws a nice deep ball too, doesn't he, Gary? He gets some pretty good air under those touch throws.
He does. And, I mean, this was another – I mean, look, 19 completions for 402 yards – and a lot of them were legit. I mean, he had the, you know, Hopkins had the 72-yard catch and run off a screen pass, but he found Will Fuller. Will Fuller ran past Earl Thomas in the first quarter to open the scoring here. They are doing stuff on offense. I just want to ask you, Andy, because I still go back to basically the first 6 quarters of Watson's season, which would be second half against Jacksonville and then the Thursday nighter against Cincinnati. The leap between that Bengals game and the Patriots game where he really started to take off, what do you see different from this team? Is the offensive line better? Is it all this, you know, there's all this motion going on with their offense now. Is that enough to sort of just put defenses on their heels here? What's going on? Why are they so much better?
They've done a really – it's a good question. And we forget, yes, that offensive line has been better. It was terrible at first, and we've said coming into the season it's probably the league's least talented offensive line. They got Dwayne Brown back today, but still some guys up there that you wouldn't trust in one-on-one scenarios. So what they're doing is forcing the defense to think the game. You can't let the defense play fast against you because, A, your quarterback's young and he's not going to play fast enough mentally a lot of the time, and B, your offensive line's not very good and they can't play fast enough physically. So we're going to put extra bodies in the backfield. We're going to show misdirection, pre-snap motion, option plays, deceptive tactics, stuff that slows the game down and makes the defense have to process, and a lot of those plays inherently define the read for the quarterback as well. So it's a really good coaching job by Bill O'Brien. I think they've played well to Watson's strengths. They haven't just – we all said coming in, well, a rookie can't run Bill O'Brien's system. They asked too much of the QB. Well, Bill O'Brien knows that, and he's a smart coach, and he's adjusted his system a little bit. They still ask a lot of their QB, but they've expanded it, and they've really built to Watson's mobility in, I would say, a healthy manner. They're not relying on it. They're not making him dependent on it, but they are consistently using it.
Yeah, this is exciting. They're going to be right in it in the AFC South, and that's something we maybe did not think once they lost Watt and Merciless a couple weeks ago. It looks like they'll just be a much different team competing for that AFC South crown this year.
Number two.
Let's go on to topic number two. That is the Sunday nighter. Again, if you were watching some World Series baseball, you probably did not catch a lot of this, but you missed a very good one. This is the Steelers and Lions in This is a really violent game. I feel like I cringed quite a few times on some of these helmet-to-helmet missile hits that went down in this one. Physical game. Steelers end up outlasting the Lions in this one. Matthew Stafford was really good in this one. Lions not very good up front. They were a little bit better tonight. And really not a whole lot of weaponry for Stafford to work with here. He was sort of he was hitting those throws up the sideline in that soft spot against cover two coverage again and again. And that sort of kept the Lions in this one, even though they didn't get it done in the red zone was the difference.
0-for-5 in the red zone. A couple of those were trips to the tight red zone inside the 5-yard line. Pittsburgh likes to rush 3 and drop 8 in the red zone. They didn't do it every time in this one, but that's what a lot of teams do now. And they put bodies back there, and it becomes difficult to deal with. And if you can't run the ball, it's hard to play in the red zone because of that rush 3, drop 8 that more teams are doing. I still think Stafford, I had him ranked number 2 as quarterback, best QBs available right now in the league, Gary. I still feel that strongly about him. Nothing about tonight changes. I thought he played exceptionally well. I thought he looked decent against the Saints, even though that was a crazy game and his numbers wound up bad because of it. The Lions, they will go as far as Stafford takes them, and he creates opportunities that normally aren't there. Those cover two throws you're talking about, those are they're not incompletions. They're just non-attempted balls for any other team on offense. That soft area is soft because the quarterback can't get it there. You don't need to cover it. With Detroit, you do. Stafford is such an arm talent.
Yeah. And really the turning point in this one, it was a tight game throughout. It was a 2015 final. Lions got down in that tight red zone. They had a second and goal from basically the half-yard line. Then they went incompletion. Dwayne Washington got stuffed on third down. And then I didn't mind going for it. I hated spreading it out. It was sort of a long one, fourth and goal from just outside the one-yard line. They spread it out, and Stafford took the sack. And then 4 plays later, we had Ben Roethlisberger to Juju Smith-Schuster for the 97-yard catch and run. Kind of a comical catch and run if you watch the running, because he's constantly looking over both shoulders and somehow just outran the defenders. But nice night for Smith-Schuster, who is he's definitely a physical presence in the run game. Really good blocker, really active blocker. But he made the play of the night tonight.
Yeah, beat Quandre Diggs, who's had a nice season, a really good run support player and a solid slot corner. Remember, I told you front of the year, Quandre Diggs, Nevin Lawson, those guys will wind up starting again for Detroit because that secondary is better than people realize, but we didn't see it on that play and several times tonight, even when the coverage was good. Pittsburgh won. Even though Roethlisberger wasn't, that was a great throw on the Smith-Schuster play, Roethlisberger, I felt, wasn't quite as sharp as usual in this game.
Yeah, I mean, he had missed one right before that for Jesse James, and like we say, he's a little bit different on the road. He's always just a little bit shakier on the road. I still, every time I see Roethlisberger in Ford Field, which I guess would be like twice now, I always think back to Super Bowl. Super Bowl 40 was like, I mean, I really think it was the worst quarterback performance I ever saw in a Super Bowl. They won, obviously, but it got to a point where they were just like, ooh, we can't have this guy attempting any sort of throw further than 5 yards downfield. That's why they started doing all the trick stuff with Randall L at that point. But as far as tonight goes, yeah, he was a little bit shaky, missed a couple of throws, but this was a nice catch and run, and they had a little nifty play to end it too, that little shovel pass to Smith-Schuster on the third and medium to convert the last first down there.
Yeah, and real quick on that 97-yard touchdown, that sequence you described, I've always espoused going for it on fourth and two or shorter when you're up against a goal line like that. I mean, you got to evaluate the flow of the game, of course. But the reason I like going for it is because that's such a field position advantage. Even if you don't get it, you pin them back so deep that you almost have to assume you get 3 points on the next drive because you're probably catching a punt at about the 50-yard line. You don't ever assume that they're going to get a 97-yard touchdown against you. I guess maybe unless you're playing with Sean Smith or something. But that's a tough one to swallow. If you're, I didn't. That's not. I wasn't fair.
I was going to say that was it. That
Sean
Smith's
a good player.
Just,
Just... Well, I remember, you know why? Because I thought, who's the last guy I saw give up a 90-yard touchdown? Yeah. Sean Smith in week one against the Saints last year. He had that horrible start to the season, and he's kind of continued with it. But that's a tough one for Mike Caldwell to deal with there. You never believe you're going to be giving up a 97-yard score, especially right down the middle like that. I mean, with Glover Quinn at safety, you would never count on that.
Exactly. No, I don't mind the aftermath of it, and I didn't mind going for it either. I said my wife can vouch for me if anyone bumps into her on the street and asks her. But I said just kick the field goal, retake the lead. When they spread out, I hated it because they didn't have an advantage anywhere. I just feel like, you know, they spread it out. They put Washington in the backfield, which means you're not going to hand it off from a shotgun formation to Dwayne Washington. That's not what he does. So now it's like you're playing, you know, a little bit of 4-on-5. I don't know exactly what was supposed to happen on that play call. It, you know, the pocket fell apart and Stafford tried to step up and it was all over. But I didn't like the matchup. I didn't like saying our guys are going to beat your guys because they were not. They probably were not.
I can't argue at that. Steelers have some really good guys on that defense.
Yeah. But yeah, you know, nice showing by both teams. Steelers obviously in good shape. Lions not so much at this point. They got to start stringing some wins together.
Number three.
Topic number three here, speaking of a team that needs to start stringing wins together, that is the Atlanta Falcons. Get one in East Rutherford in the pouring rain. I think they were better today offensively. And we'll focus on that side of the ball first. I thought they were better offensively. More stuff over the middle, more in-breaking stuff. They got the tight ends involved early. Their tight ends are not world beaters, but they use them, and that opens some things up later. I think this was a game, again, it was in the rain. There were a lot of wet ball-related drops. Matt Ryan lost two fumbles on quarterback center exchanges. So there were some sloppy mistakes that were really a result of the weather. But they moved the ball for the most part anyway, and then for once the Falcons finally caught some breaks late. They got a muffed punt, and then they got a long punt return to seal it. So special teams did it. But I think they're kind of trending up-ish, let's say, going forward.
Well, their running game worked today, and the Jets' strength on defense is that run defense. It's been inconsistent given the amount of talent they have, but lately Darren Lee has played faster, which is a sign of a guy getting more comfortable, and he's a fast player. Obviously, Leonard Williams, Steve McClendon can do stuff. Wilkerson started to show up a little bit last week and show signs of Muhammad Wilkerson life there. So to be able to go on the road and run the ball against those guys and their running backs in Atlanta, Coleman and Freeman, they had 26 carries, 123 yards between them. Mm-hmm. There's some sustainability there. Coleman did have the 52-yarder, but they got the run game as their foundation. And Matt Forte for the Jets, on the other hand, I believe the Jets ran the ball, 19 times to running backs. Forte only had four of those, and he kind of voiced it afterwards, didn't he?
He
said he was a little surprised that they didn't keep running the ball. Matt Forte does not have a reputation as that kind of guy, and he's a veteran, he's been around a long time, for him to speak out is a little bit revealing.
Yeah, I just think it's a little bit harsh, too, just because, I mean, come on, this Jets team wasn't supposed to score any points this year, and they're actually scoring some points, and Robbie Anderson is doing some good things. And yes, it was a sloppy, you know, sloppy, rainy day, but, you know, they had a lead. They held the lead for most of the game, and they lost it late. I don't know. I watched this game fairly closely. I didn't really have a huge problem with the play calling, especially since the Jets didn't do a whole lot on the ground. It's not like they had 22 rushes. It's not like they picked up 120 with those. They picked up 43 yards. So it's not like they had anything going well at that point. But Falcons have a really tough stretch of games coming up. I think this was the kind of game they looked better offensively. Schematically, it didn't seem like they had the same type of problems they had. They had a lot of big plays. They had six plays of 20 yards or longer. And this was a game that they, you know, it was a sloppy game, but it's a game they pulled out. And I think that might be the kind of thing that gets them headed in the right direction going forward after basically everyone wanted Steve Sarkisian's head this time last week.
Yeah, no, you'll take any win on the road in the NFL. Absolutely.
All right, Andy, before we move on, You know, my family, it is an autumn family. We like the weather. We like Halloween. We like Thanksgiving. We don't like raking leaves, but we do like jumping in them. I'm sure you all know someone like that. And I have the perfect surprise gift for someone who loves fall, whether it's a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, a fresh bouquet in their favorite fall colors from Pro Flowers. I got one for my wife and daughter recently, and it's still in the center of our dining room table. Still looks beautiful, lasts so much longer than we ever thought it would. Their best-selling cinnamon cider roses are a great option for any fall occasion, or go with one of the classics like 100 Autumn Blooms or a dozen Autumn Roses. You can't lose because no matter which bouquet you send, our listeners get 20% off any Pro Flowers unique bouquets of $29 or more. Pro Flowers bouquets are guaranteed to stay fresh for at least 7 days or your money back, and you control the delivery date. Pro Flowers gives you more bloom for your buck. Big, beautiful flowers, more stems for your money, and long-lasting freshness. To get 20% off all bouquets of $29 or more, go to proflowers.com and use our promo code THINGS at checkout. That's proflowers.com and code THINGS, THINGS.
Number four.
All right, Andy, topic four. This is the Cowboys go to Washington. You know, we talked about how sloppy the weather was in the Jets-Falcons game. It was just as bad, if not worse, down at FedEx Field. I don't know what you can take away from this game except for the fact that the Cowboys ran the ball well again, and they got a key division road win. But, you know, weather played a huge factor. This one turned around. Redskins had a lead and were about to stretch it to a two-possession lead late in the first half, and then they had a field goal block that the Cowboys got a touchdown run directly off of, and that sort of, you know, it was all downhill at that point. The other thing for Washington is they were missing three offensive linemen going into this one. They lost a fourth. Morgan Moses is the last man standing. They're just playing four basically street free agents next to him at this point, and Kirk Cousins just got hammered in this one by a Cowboys pass rush that got it done today. But I don't know, you know, I don't know how much you really read into the greatness of that outing.
Yeah, they got the Cousin four times for sacks officially. And if you're short along your offensive line, then it's a tough decision for a coach. Do we run the ball and try to be dictatorial about it and at least be in command, even though our players aren't very good, so what are we really commanding? Or do we throw and try to work around it and believe the ball can get out before our pass protection can break down? And at least with Dallas, what you do know is you're going to get a four-man rush. You'll get some defensive line slant. You'll get some twists. But they're not going to give you a ton of fronts to read and then a ton of pressure packages. I mean, they'll make it hard on you a little bit, but this is not the Minnesota Vikings or the Houston Texans with all these different sub-package looks that you might get. So you can put backups in there and have them expect to see the type of stuff that they saw in training camp and whenever it was they last played. There's no good answer here. We're talking about playing worse players. But Washington's approach in this one, even with the weather, was to try to throw their way out of it. And Gary, they're 3-4 now, and my sense is that will be their record. They're going to be that type of team until they get their outside wide receivers going, or I should say until those outside wide receivers get themselves going. Terrell Pryor has regressed. He was a non-factor again today. Josh Doctson had the one catch, the one-yard touchdown. That was all he did. This team right now is really dependent on its running back and its inside receivers. Crowder, Grant a little bit, and those tight ends. They do a great job scheming for them. At some point, though, those schemes are dependent on the outside guys winning, and the less you get from those guys, the more limited your schemes become.
Yeah, and like you said, Doctson and Pryor combined one catch for 1 yard. I mean, those are the two guys. Those are the two sort of natural supreme talents they have in this receiving core on the outside, and it's just not – it's not happening right now. And Jordan Reed left this one with a hamstring injury. They also lost Niles Paul to a concussion. So any two tight end stuff went out the window at that point. And Ryan Kerrigan got banged up, injured his groin, ended up coming back, but was not quite the same. He actually looked really good early in this game. And then just, he once he got hurt, he was not his usual self. So this was this is a rough situation for Washington right now. They're kind of on the brink now, and I don't really know how they get out of it because they just they're out of players. They're out of healthy players.
Number five.
That is the Panthers and the Bucks. The Panthers, you know, it's all we've talked about the offense so much. It was the defense again this week. Defense shut down the Bucks in Tampa. This was a 17-3 win. That's no touchdowns allowed for a second straight week for this Panthers defense. Of course, they gave up the two long Chicago Bears defensive scores last week to lose that game. But they were dominant in this one. Luke Kuechly was back. And, you know, this we talk so much about Cam and Cam's problems with sort of the inconsistencies with what they ask him to do now and all that. And you kind of forget how good this team can be defensively. Kurt Coleman also back, by the way.
Yeah, and that's a big difference. Having Kurt Coleman and Kuechly back, those are two sagacious veterans, disguising veterans. Coleman's great at disguising his coverages, which is important in that kind of a zone scheme. Mm-hmm. Kuechly, obviously, you know what he does. They put Thomas Davis back in the nickel today. I don't know what was going on with Shaq Thompson. He's been the nickel linebacker with Kuechly this season. They've actually, at times, they've played all three of those guys against three wide receiver sets. In fact, they've done that a lot of the time. So they like their linebackers, but they didn't play as many three down or three linebacker packages against three wide receivers today because Captain Munnerlyn was in the game and he's their featured blitzer. And that's the difference with this defense under Steve Wilks, Gary. The new coordinator, he's really turned them in to a blitz-oriented defense. I'm sure a lot of people watched that Thursday night game a few weeks ago with Carolina against Philadelphia. They didn't win that game, but they were dominant with their blitz packages. They've continued that. That has remained indicative of the way they've played. Steve Wilks has made this a more aggressive scheme, and he's also getting the cornerback play to back it up. Bradbury traveled with Mike Evans today, our guy James Bradbury, who remains a very good corner, good spatial reasoning in zone, understands routes and how to win when guys get at the top of their routes. They believe he's a true number one corner, and they're using him like that. So a little bit of a different mix now. You've got some speed and some edge rushers, edge blitzers, and some matchup cornerbacks. Even though they're a zone defense, they're a harder defense to play against now.
Yeah, and as far as the Bucks go, this has... You know, this has fallen apart. They're 2-5 now. This is a division home loss that they really couldn't afford to have at this point. And, yeah, I don't know. They've had issues defensively all year, and the offense couldn't get anything done today. And this might just be a lost season for them.
Starting to look like that. The overriding issue, the issue today was Jameis Winston wasn't as sharp. The offense got outplayed. Mm-hmm. But that's – Winston's fine. They've had a – you know, they're okay offensively. I'm sure Dirk Koetter can tell you eight things that he wishes they were doing better right now. But the offense is not the issue. The issue is the defense. There's no pass rush, and it's a straight zone scheme. And you can't be a straight zone scheme. You cannot be that if you don't have a pass rush.
They should have won the Dwight Freeney bidding war. Dwight Freeney, by the way, we didn't mention it, but Dwight Freeney is back. We talked about him last week. The Seahawks scooped him up. He played in that game today. So,
yeah, flashed a spin move on his first snap there. He probably had about five snaps, I'm guessing, in the game.
Yeah.
But he'll be a factor at some point.
Number six.
Topping number six, Patriots Chargers. You know, talking about defense here, this was another promising day for the Patriots defense. They gave up a long touchdown, 87-yard touchdown run to Melvin Gordon early in this one, but they really didn't give up much after that. I mean, they only gave up six other points. They held the Chargers to under 300 yards. Other than that, it looks like they've sort of gotten it together defensively at this point.
The Dante Hightower injury is a big one, and how do they account for him, and what do they do? My sense is you never know for sure with them. Because Hightower played defensive end. They moved him to what amounted to defensive end. They might call it a strong outside linebacker, whatever it is they call it. He plays up on the line of scrimmage. He's the last guy there. He sets the edge. He's the Rob Ninkovich role. They've had three really good edge setters, and that's a big part of their scheme. Jabal Sheard, who's now gone. Ninkovich, who's retired, and Hightower, who's out injured. So what do they do there? My sense is they'll probably have Kyle Van Noy give it a shot, have David Harris be a stack linebacker. Elandon Roberts is their most dynamic stack linebacker in that scenario. The sooner they get that figured out, the better, though. And they did in this game now, but it's going to be – let's hope it's not too much of musical chairs, because that one has to get solved. They can mess around and play different guys at cornerback all season long. You know, they have such good safeties, and they play safety help on a lot of coverages. They can toy with their secondary a little bit. They can't keep toying with their front seven. They need someone that can set the edge. Today was a good start.
Yeah. And look, the secondary was shaky early in the year. No Stephon Gilmore again today because of the concussion. They were good. They held up just fine. And even the one play, Travis Benjamin got behind Malcolm Butler for a 24-yard touchdown pass. It looked like on the play that Butler was not prepared for the snap. There was some sort of pre-snap communication coming in, and he didn't realize the play had started until it was too late. But you know, that's the kind of stuff that can get cleaned up as they go forward here. The one play I do want to mention from this game, and again, Travis Benjamin, 5 catches, 64 yards and a touchdown. Nice day for him offensively. I cannot remember this ever happening, but he turned a punt return into a safety. He fielded a punt at the 8-yard line and went backwards. His momentum was going backwards when he fielded it. And, you know, he grabbed it at the 8-yard line along the sideline and tried to circle all the way back, ended up running back into the end zone and taking a safety. And I've never seen that. I mean, it was a negative 8-yard return for a safety. That's bad.
Yeah, I don't have one off the top of my head. The closest I've seen is when a guy accidentally takes it out of the end zone on a kick. This was on kick returns, and then crossed it just a little bit, and then thought, oh, never mind. I'm gonna touch back and, you know, retreat it. I mean, I think I saw that once or twice growing up. But yeah, to get a safety on a punt return is quite remarkable because it takes two atrocious decisions. One, whatever you did when you were running around, and two, catching the ball in the first place.
It was very Washington Generals. That's what that moment was. It felt like some point shaving was going on or something like that. But it happened, and it ended up being a pretty key 2 points there. The final was 21-13. The Chargers did have a chance late. The Patriots retreated into that soft zone, and Rivers had them in position to go for a final play there, and ended up being an interception. But
remember, folks, with safeties, they're not just 2 points. They're also turnovers. You have to punt the ball back to the other team. There's a huge field position swing because you're not punting from a very good spot. So it's 2 points plus. Really, they should be counted as a turnover. They're much more like an interception on fourth down. To me, that's not a turnover. A safety's much more of a turnover than some of the things we actually count as turnovers.
So the Patriots punted that ball from their own 35, and then they pick up the 2 points on that play. And then they get the ball back at their own 43, so that was the turnaround there. I know we like our
swings. So it's like a free 2 points, but also remember by getting the ball back, that's one less possession for the Chargers. Possessions are where your points come from,
yes.
Typically, unless you're punting and they're returning it to their own end zone for you.
In 15 seconds, they picked up 8 yards and 2 points, and then they went down and kicked the field goal. So
while taking a possession from the Chargers, big swing in the game.
Yep. It was. All right, Andy, before we go on, you know, they say in life there are no guarantees. They say there's no sure thing. Well, I'm here to tell you that there might just be one exception. In 1924, Husky started making things for people who make things, and they did it with common sense. That meant adding function, never frills, and making tools that stood the test of time. 93 years later, Husky is still making quality crafted, durable tools, and Husky stands by their hand tools for life, so they give their hand tools a lifetime warranty. Like the Husky Ratchet, with a 100-position ratcheting design and a 10% longer handle than standard ratchets to do what other ratchets can't. Or the virtually unbreakable Husky Flashlight, with the ability to withstand a 30-foot drop and work in up to 1 meter of water submersion. Both guaranteed for a lifetime, but built so that you won't need it. Now that's a pretty sure thing. And to Husky, that's common sense. Husky, common sense tools since 1924 with hand tools guaranteed for a lifetime. Found only at the Home Depot.
Number seven.
Okay, topic number seven, Andy. This was the Raiders go to Buffalo and fall victim to the Bills. I mean, this was the Billsiest game you could imagine. The Bills end up forcing four turnovers. They do not turn it over at all themselves. And they, on top of that, they rush 37 times for 166. They control the ball for 35-37. I mean, this is exactly how the Bills wanted this game to go, and that's probably why this ended up being a 20-point win.
And the question is, can the Bills keep winning like this, with this formula and the way they do it? And I am skeptical. To me, if it feels like a 10-6 wild card and out, and that was a nice season type of thing, I am skeptical.
They will take that in Buffalo, by the way.
Yeah, they would. They would. And I don't mean to be a doubter. I mean, these are legitimate victories they're getting. They are a good team. What are they, 5-2 now? I mean, they are what their record says they are. I think it's hard to sustain success with this kind of approach over the course of the season. But, you know, they've got the running back to do it. LeSean McCoy can create his own yards. And Sean McDermott's done such a great job with that defense. Those safeties are playing really well. Jordan Poyer, the former Brown, and then Micah Hyde, the former Packer. Micah Hyde's been as good as any safety in the league this season.
Yeah, Hyde's been great. Poyer missed this game.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly what the injury was, but he sat this one out. But they still, you know, they got it done. This was another sloppy weather game. But you know, they got two fumbles. Their turnovers, the only reason I'm hesitant to be really excited about this is the turnovers are just, they're so odd. It, you know, it's tipped passes, and it's you know, in one of these it was I can't remember if it was Rashard or DeAndre Washington. Basically, you know, he had caught a ball over the middle and sort of just shoveled it into Matt Milano's hands, who then runs it 40 yards for a touchdown. It's that kind of stuff. But they keep on they keep on getting these. So, you know, it, to an extent, it's also, you know, being in the right place at the right time and being prepared to take advantage of these things. What's the saying? Luck is preparation meets something else, opportunity.
Yep, I think that is. And Milano, you mentioned Matt Milano. He's a great illustration of how this team's performing. When he first came in a few weeks ago, he came in mid-game. Somebody got hurt. I had him down on my film notes. He looked like a backup. I mean, he was unprepared. He got plays attacking him, and it worked out well. You put on the film now, he plays fast. And whenever young guys, especially when they play faster, quickly, you see the improvement. It's always a sign of good coaching. Guys are getting it. They're understanding. Milano was not getting a lot of reps early on in the season. Now that he's getting reps, he's playing faster. So the practice time is paying off. And the other thing about this coaching, Gary, Rick Dennison as offensive coordinator, there are a handful of coordinators this year. Pat Shurmur is another one that are doing an unbelievably sound, smart job with what they're working with. And the Vikings with Case Keenum now are 6-2. The Bills with Tyrod Taylor, they're right up there at the top of the AFC East, and they have a very distinct identity on offense. A lot of play action, crossing routes, those three-level crossing routes where there's one guy shallow, one guy going at the 15-yard range, and then someone deep over the top to control the safety. You high-low defenders that way. One guy's high, one guy's low, and it's a pretty simple read for the QB, and it's a ball that Taylor throws really well. They've done that a lot all season long. They get to it out of a number of different ways. They've had a ton of success, and it's all back to Rick Dennison, and he's coaching that really well.
Yeah, and look, they don't make mistakes on offense. I mean Taylor, no turnovers today, didn't take any sacks today. Yeah, this team kind of reminds me of it kind of reminds me of watching like Syracuse basketball the last couple years when they, you know, Syracuse basketball, they sit back in a zone even though they have superior athletes against most teams. They just kind of say, well, no one in college basketball can shoot or create offense in any sort of intelligent way, so we're just going to stand back a little bit and watch you screw up because we just trust you will not do everything correctly because no one in college basketball does anymore. So, you know, a game like this, the Bills just have a chance to sort of sit back in that zone and just tell the Raiders, like, okay, well, let's see you go, you know, 80 yards in 10 plays here. And yeah, chances are you're not going to do it.
That's the, you just described the core theory behind zone defense. That's at its most basic level. That's the thinking behind zone is, you're going to give up some yards, but at some point something will go wrong for the offense, and then the tables are turned, and that's how you play.
Well, Jim Boeheim running things out in Buffalo, even if they don't even know it.
Number 8.
Let's go on to topic number 8. This was the London game, Browns Vikings. I'll just start with this on this one. This was the first time all season the Browns have led a game at halftime, and this was a game that they led. They were up 16-15 late in the third quarter, and they end up losing this one by 17. And I don't know. I don't know what kind of sense you got of this, Andy. It seemed like there was no chance the Browns were going to close this one out, and they sort of just needed a break down the stretch or something. But, I mean, this is a team that's they're incapable of closing out a game.
Well, and leading at halftime probably really complicates Hugh Jackson's plans of benching DeShone Kizer for
yes,
our 20th time in a row. So I've seen every snap of the Browns, and here's their issue. For one, they don't have wide receivers mm-hmm. who can win at all. Those guys cannot win on an island. So they're playing, and they did not do this today, by the way. The first half, they really – it was all screen concepts, variety of screen passes. They were really controlling Kizer. My sense, they also could be that they've got Spencer Drango in there at left tackle now instead of Joe Thomas, and they don't want Drango trying to block Everson Griffin. So
yep,
we're going to have a screen game. We're gonna rely on that. But for the most part, other than the first half of this game, all season long – the Browns have been running these deep isolation routes with these wide receivers that can't get open, that just aren't good enough. And they're asking their rookie quarterback to drop back and play behind it. Now, that rookie QB has had the pass protection to make it work. He does have a decent running game. He's got the talent there. But he's reading receivers that can't get themselves open. And the second he makes a mistake, he's getting benched. Because I would love to just sit down and ask Hugh Jackson in an honest moment, or whoever it is making these decisions, what did you expect from Kizer when you got him, when
yeah,
you drafted him, and when you decided to make him your starter? Because when you put on the film, he looks like a rookie. He's inconsistent, but his highs are pretty good. Throws a nice ball. You see him working within the process of the offense, and then he does something wrong, and he's been getting benched for it. And I just, for the life of me, don't understand what they thought the plan was going to be, because so far, nothing unexpected has happened with this team. Kizer's been what anybody else in that position would be, and it worries me. You know who it reminds me of a little bit, Gary, is Geno Smith with the Jets. He was in the same scenario a few years ago, and I actually thought he had a nice rookie season. He had way too many interceptions, but they were interceptions because they were asking him to make deeper reads, downfield, aggressive throws. Kizer does that too. Now, his interceptions are coming from different reasons, but the overarching point is you're asking these guys to run full-fledged offenses that don't necessarily define the reads for them schematically, and they don't have a lot of good players around them, and they look like rookies when they do it.
Yeah, and Kizer, you know, he avoided turnovers today, so that was a start. The biggest upset of the season that I've seen so far was Ricardo Lewis making a catch down the left sideline against Xavier Rhodes for 37 yards that set up a touchdown late in the first half.
That was a man-free coverage.
I still can't believe that.
I couldn't either. And I don't think the Vikings, I'm not sure I've seen them play man-free coverage in a 2-minute situation, you said, right? That was, they don't play that coverage very often either.
I think it was just outside the 2-minute warning.
But it was an obvious pass situation, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, it was it was 3rd and 12. Oh, it was right at the 2-minute warning. So it was 3rd and 12. First play after the 2-minute warning, 37
yards.
Yeah,
so essentially, two obvious pass. And I rewound it and watched it again just to verify. Like that wasn't Xavier Rhodes, was it? Like sure, that couldn't be.
I was sitting on my couch, probably half asleep at that point. And when I saw it, I literally got down on my hands and knees and crawled up to my TV to make sure I was seeing the uniform number correctly on Xavier Rhodes, and it wasn't actually Trey Waynes that happened to be playing right corner on that play and got beat.
Yeah.
But
By the way, had a nice game. Trey Waynes has been up and down this year. He has solidified. He had a bad September. His October, though, has finished pretty strong.
Yeah, and I mean, look, people are going to throw at him by default because he's not Xavier Rhodes. So, Case Keenum and Jerick McKinnon, I would describe the two of them as nifty in this game. I thought Keenum, I didn't think the protection was great. I thought Keenum moved around really well, both on some of the design stuff and just sort of moving around within the pocket and creating some plays and certainly enough plays in the end against the Browns in this one.
Oh, Keenum has been exactly what you want a backup to be. Total professional, has looked 100% prepared in every game that he's played. That's a credit to Pat Shurmur, who we mentioned earlier. It's a credit to their new QB coach, Kevin Stefanski. And it's a big credit to Case Keenum for being ready to go. And he's trusting the offense. That's how you know it's a well-coached offense. Keenum is moving within the pocket, which he did not do very well with the Rams last year. And I think those Rams coaches, they'll tell you in an honest moment, they'll say they didn't help him out enough. They didn't do enough to make the game easier for Keenum. And he is a guy that you have to kind of, he has to know what he's doing in order to thrive. He can't just drop back and make a play. He has to have a very deliberate mission because he's not a big pocket passer and he's not a super talent. And he does know what he's doing here in Minnesota. The reads have been clear. They're not easy reads. They're total full-fledged route combinations. Keenum's looked 100% prepared almost every week he's been out there. They're 6-2 with their backup quarterback in. Nobody's talking about this.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, they had Bradford for the opener, and Bradford, last time we saw him, he played the first half in Chicago in that Monday nighter and was not able to, you know, he shouldn't have been on the field probably. So, you know, this has basically been all Keenum for the most part this year, except for the opener. So another nice win for the Vikings here.
Number 9.
Andy, it is time for topic 9. That is the lightning-ish round, and it will be fairly fast today. There's only 3 games. We're also going to talk about a trade that went down this past week. But let's start with the games. Eagles, 49ers. I guess the takeaway for this one, not surprising, the Eagles win this game with relative ease, 33-10. Niners coming across country with a rookie quarterback. It just wasn't a very good formula. The Eagles had protection issues. It wasn't necessarily Vitae. It was sort of across the offensive line. They weren't very good against the Niners front today. How do you feel about Wentz if he is going to have shaky offensive line play the rest of the year? Is his ability to extend plays and to make plays outside the pocket, is that enough for them to get by and basically be just fine?
Absolutely it is, if he can keep doing that. We're going to learn about the real maturation of Carson Wentz here, because last season, when his mechanics started to waver for that stretch in the middle of the year, the people close to him will tell you it correlated with Lane Johnson being unavailable. And Vitae came in at right tackle. Wentz, in his heart of heart, didn't trust Vitae to get the job done. Vitae, remember, he got lit up by Ryan Kerrigan when he first came in. And this was last season when Lane Johnson, someone got hurt, I think, in that one. And Vitae came in, got destroyed. And that kind of set the tone for Wentz. And Wentz was not the same QB after that. Mm-hmm. Well, Wentz is in a similar scenario now. He's relying on Vitae again. Jason Peters, who proved me very wrong and is having an excellent season, goes down. And Wentz will have to adjust. And by the way, they're running a deeper passing game than they were last season, a much more of a deep drop-back passing game.
Yeah.
So let's see how Carson Wentz does. He now did well today. And I know the Niners, I know they're winless, but the Niners are not a joke up front. They've got Brenston Buckner is a true superstar. Solomon Thomas, he's learning the game. He's had some rookies ups and downs, but the talent is there. You still have to account for that. It's not the easiest front four to play against.
Saints and Bears. Saints do it with the defense again. 20-12 in this one. Trubisky looked pretty good. Made a couple of nice throws. The nice part for the Saints again, you know, the offense didn't light it up. This wasn't another, you know, 40-38 type of win. This was this, you know, they're winning games in a different way this year.
Their defense has gotten a lot better. That's a faster unit. They do a lot of things schematically. Typically, when you play faster, it's in those simpler schemes. The Saints play fast, and they're in a high-volume, multifaceted scheme. They do a lot of stuff where they cover the center, so it's kind of a true 3-4 in the base. And then when you cover the center and the sub-packages and rush the passer, you can really dictate matchups, because by covering the center, you eliminate him as anybody's help in pass protection. The center has to block the guy covering him. So now it's two men over here blocking, two men over there blocking, and you can build your pass rushes accordingly. They've done a really good job diversifying there. And the way they can play this way, they've got two corners that are playing great football. Ken Crawley, who is good on underneath routes. He needs to be a little more trusting of himself on deeper routes. He's grabby at the end of vertical plays, but he's played very well. And then Marshawn Lattimore has played as well as not just any rookie corner, but any corner period in the NFL this season, man and zone coverage.
Mm-hmm. They're getting it done. One more note from this game, and I know when I tell you to not look it up, it just makes you want to look it up more, but there's a play in this game. Zach Miller caught a 25-yard touchdown midway through the third quarter that would have made this one pretty interesting. And he came down, and it was another one of those just absolutely stomach-turning injuries where his you know, you can see his leg has done things that the human leg should not do. But the ridiculous part of this, and not to laugh because it was a disgusting and I'm sure extremely painful injury, you know, they celebrate the touchdown and they put him in the cart and they're taking him off, and they reviewed the touchdown and decided he had not completed the catch. There was no specific explanation that came down. But Fox had already said, we're not going to show you this replay again because of the it's such a graphic injury. But then once they overturned the touchdown, they kind of had to go back and show it, and they showed like five more replays of it because no one could figure out how it was possibly not a catch. But it ended up being taken off the board. They kicked the field goal instead. I don't know if the Bears were going to score enough points to actually win this game anyway, but it was sort of it was literally insult to injury at that point.
That's too bad, and Zach Miller's been a solid player for a long time in the NFL.
Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be a while before we see him again. Last game we're going to talk about here, this is the Bengals and the Colts. I think everyone's sort of expecting the Bengals to romp in this one. Everyone has sort of left the Colts for dead, especially after losing Malik Hooker, and they had no Rashawn Melvin in this one. He's been pretty good in their secondary this year. Instead, it ended up being a very tight game. Carlos Dunlap has to save the day with a pick six late in this one to turn it into a 24-23 Bengals victory. The Bengals did not move the ball in this game. They had one long screen pass to Joe Mixon. Other than that, they did very little offensively. They got a win, so you're happy about that. But to have to squeak one out against this Colts team on your home field is not terribly encouraging.
All right, so I have a Carlos Dunlap story here.
Yeah,
I spent all of Wednesday with the Bengals. I got mm-hmm. to see everything, their game plan installation, all their meetings, walked out on their everything in their practice. It was a lot of fun. So I know exactly. Can't wait to watch a film because I know exactly what they're doing in this game. I don't have to even figure it out for myself. But Carlos Dunlap, for one, he's huge. He's enormous.
Yeah.
And he walks around with this smiley, like he's got this really bright energy about him. And he doesn't say much. He just has a lot of facial expressions, and he's chipper, and he keeps going on about his way. So at one point I'm standing there, and someone fixed my collar on my shirt, which I guess had been wrong all day long, and Carlos
yep.
Dunlap. And he just walks by without breaking stride. Like, that's just what he does. It's almost like you almost think he might be mute or deaf or something, because he's just in his own happy world, but he's interacting with everybody without saying anything. At one point, he picked up a basketball in one of their training rooms. They had a basketball, because actually the only time I've ever seen a basketball court of AstroTurf. Like, it's AstroTurf, but a basketball court. And I thought, I can't wait to. Yeah, I know it was. But it works for him.
Okay.
It's a half court, so it's not like they're playing. They're not running five on five out there. But I thought, I can't wait to watch. He's going to shoot around for a few minutes. They were in between drills. They had a meeting in 5 minutes. And I was going to watch him play basketball. He picks up the ball. The you know how you can tell who can play and not play the second they touch the ball? Usually,
yes.
A lot of times it's on the first dribble.
Yep.
Carlos Dunlap cannot play. It
really?
Was embarrassing. The second he dribbled the ball, he looked like the guy who has his shoes on the wrong feet. And then he pulls up for a three-point shot, a jumper. It's the most hideous looking jump shot I've ever seen. I mean, it's like Sean Marion, if Marion had cocked it off to the side. Remember the old player for the Suns and 10,000 other teams? And I thought that, so when it leaves his hand, I thought this is going to look really good, because there's no way a guy this athletic can go through life shooting such an ugly shot if the shot didn't work for him. So I'm watching the ball's flight, ugliest shot I've ever seen. It's like, all right, I'm about to be wild. The ball hits the bottom part of the backboard, not the rim. The rim was nowhere in sight. Bottom part of the backboard, and he has to go rebound it himself, of course. He couldn't play. So on the drive home, I was there at Vontaze Burfict all day. And on the drive home, I asked Vontaze Burfict, he's best friends with Dunlap. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, have you ever seen Dunlap play basketball? And I asked it kind of delicately, and he knew exactly why I was asking. And I told him what I'd seen. And he said, yeah, Dunlap's the most uncoordinated guy you've ever seen, even though he's one of the best athletes in the NFL. According to Vontaze Burfict, Dunlap can't – he's 6'7 with those long arms.
Yep.
Can't even dunk. Can't even dunk a basketball.
No, that I don't believe.
I didn't either. He said in Dunlap – or Burfict said it comes down to more lack of coordination. It's just an unbelievable – guy can't handle a ball. And so he has a game-winning interception in this one the same
in
week.
In an incredibly athletic
ball.
Play. Yeah, incredibly athletic play. It was a quick throw. He got his hands up, deflects it, grabs it, and runs it for a touchdown.
Well, I'm telling you, if he had tried to do the old Alvin Harper or Jimmy Graham celebration, he would have embarrassed himself.
just Grant Hill drink Sprite the thing into the bottom crossbar.
Oh, it was hard to watch. All of it was. And Burfict said, yeah, it's been like that for years.
That's unreal, because he literally is. I mean, I think the cliche would be he's built like a power forward. I mean, you would very easily see him on a basketball court the way he's built. But
oh, he has one of the most imposing figures I've ever seen in the NFL. He is long. Long, and it's a total waste. Absolutely goes towards nothing, except, I guess, of course, being a defensive end, which he does pretty well.
Yes.
But everything else is a total waste.
he'll never make it in life. Last thing we want to talk about, Andy, before we hit the weekly awards. Big trade. Surprising trade. Not that surprising, because, this guy was sort of being shopped anyway, no matter what the Bills want to say. But Marcell Dareus goes to Jacksonville for a sixth rounder. This was sort of a no-brainer for the Bills to do. They wanted to get out from under this contract for quite a while. What do you think, Andy? I'm not crazy about it, especially the long-term ramifications for the Jaguars. But what does Dareus do in the very near term for the Jacksonville Jaguars?
Well, when I first heard about the trade, I saw, sixth-round pick. Yeah, it's just the Jaguars taking a flyer on a guy. That makes sense. He's a talented guy. He'll play in a 4-3, get up the field a little bit. Maybe he flashes like he did early in his career, and that was my thought. And then I think 2 days went by, or a day or whatever, and it dawned on me, hey, wait a minute. Dareus's contract comes with him. They have to pay Marcell Dareus. And that's where I got baffled, because that's a bad contract. And the Bills, that's why the Bills dealt him. They didn't want to pay him, and he wasn't working out for the new staff. The new staff didn't think highly of him. You could tell by the amount of playing time he got. Mm-hmm. But I am shocked that Jacksonville would trade for the guy, given that they have to acquire the bulk of his contract as part of that deal.
Yeah, I mean, they have some cash-on-hand problems in Jacksonville right now because of ticket sales. That's one part of it. They'll have to pay quite a bit for the rest of the season for Dareus. But they're pretty much locked in for eight figures, a little more than $10 million for 2018. And that's what sort of drove me nuts about this, because they were already very snug against the cap, and they're going to have to cut some guys that they probably would not like to cut next year. And they probably would like to get involved in the quarterback market as well. And there will be a lot of veteran quarterbacks available. And this was sort of, they had They had one bullet in the gun to fire next offseason, and it looks like this is sort of taking it up at this point. In theory, he's going to upgrade their run defense. I guess that was the goal here. They play those lightish linebackers. They've been burned by some run team by some rushing attacks earlier this year. I don't know. It made me.
There are
sad.
Better run players. There are better run players for less money than that available around the NFL.
But granted, I mean, if you wanted a midseason upgrade, you can't really get one. You're not going to get a street free agent who's as good as Darius, obviously. But
if you're willing to trade, I mean, if the other theory, like I'm seeing our old friend Robert Mays, he's now at the Ringer. He was at MMQB for a little while. In fact, he was here before you, Cass. Why you're here, Gary? You replaced Robert Mays on the podcast.
I did.
Darius Mays's theory is that the Jags are going all in on a Super Bowl, and you'd say, well, Jacksonville, they're getting 8 sacks a game, whatever it is they're getting. They got 10 the last game. Well, they can't keep doing that. And Jacksonville's answer is, yes, we can. At least that's the thinking. So if that's to say Mays is right. Let's say they are trying to make a run, and they're going to be an ultra-defensive playmaking team. Well, then they should be willing to deal a second or a third-round draft pick and go out and get, like, an Akeem Hicks. Or so I'm not saying Chicago would trade Akeem Hicks.
Yeah.
But that kind of guy, a true thundering run defender, rather than Marcell Dareus, who, yeah, maybe he'll be good, maybe he'll be bad, we don't know.
It's making me pretty sad. I mean, on top of that, and we talked about this last offseason, it is very much a buyer's market for defensive tackles. I mean, Jonathan Hankins was basically on the market all last offseason, not because he's not a quality player, but because no one's looking for defensive tackles because there's so many quality ones around the league and so many quality ones coming out of college. So this one, you know, we'll see. Hey, maybe he's dominant. You know, Doug Marrone had him in Buffalo for Darius's best two seasons, and maybe he can unleash that, and then all of a sudden you have a absolutely terrifying defense. I mean, they're already one of the best, and this might put them over the top as the best. But
still pricey
just,
to do that.
I just can't get past the fact that this team is probably going to be better in 2018 than they were in 2017, just because they're so young, and they have basically punted the chance to make any sort of major improvement, as far as we know, for 2018, and that is bumming me out. That's all I got on that one. Good for the Bills for moving him once again. Just good things happening in Buffalo.
Number 10.
Topic number 10, Andy, the weekly awards. Offensive player of the week, who do you have?
You better go first here. I'm running through the games I saw in my mind here.
Oh, well, I'll give it to Russell Wilson then. I thought I'd let you go first and be a nice guy, but I will give it to Russell Wilson for the otherworldly performance, in which the defense didn't show up, the running game didn't show up, as usual, didn't have great pass protection, and he just made throw after throw and chunk play after chunk play.
Okay, I'll go LeSean McCoy running the ball effectively in a nice victory. And again, McCoy's going to have to be the guy that does that every week for them because they're building their offense around him.
All right, defensive player of the week. I'm going to give it to Luke Kuechly for the welcome back game. Sort of across the defense for the Panthers in this one, but they couldn't run on him, and Kuechly had a nice interception, pretty easy interception, a little stick route by Cameron Brait. But Luke Kuechly, welcome back, buddy.
Yes, I like that one. That's a good one. I feel like I need to give it to Dunlap after telling that story. Do you think that
I was gonna say
fair
gotta,
game?
He won't show up at your house and I don't know, try and throw a basketball at you and miss by quite a bit, or whatever his revenge would be.
Yeah, no, if he shows up with a bat, I mean, he can bring a basket. I'm not going to worry about him then. If he shows up empty-handed, I'll get a little uneasy. But I'll go Carlos Dunlap.
Okay. Special teams player of the week. Do you have anyone,
Travis,
Andy?
Travis Benjamin's mine. We already talked about him.
Right. Well, I was going to give – I'll give it to Ryan Allen for turning the punt into 2 points. Punters don't do that very often, so good for him.
All right.
Coach of the week.
Change up there. And then coach of the week. Boy, who do you got? You know, how about this? How about Mike Tomlin for going the road on Sunday night? It's never super easy. They've had a little bit of a distracting week. and they've got a star player acting like a moron, and Tomlin early in the week says, you're done, you're sitting down, and then the guys that they played in his place, Smith-Schuster, Hayward Bade, Justin Hunter got more reps, but mainly Smith-Schuster, dominated, played very well, and it went just fine for the Steelers, and Martavis Bryant standing there on the sideline too, still gets to travel with the team, so he has to stand there and not play in front of everybody on national TV. I like the way Mike Tomlin handled that one.
All right, I like that one. I'm going to go back in time. I'm going to go with the Thursday nighter. I'll give it to John Harbaugh for the 40-0 win for the beleaguered Baltimore Ravens and for getting in Kiko Alonso's face in defense of his quarterback. And I'll ask you real quick,
Andy. I think he did that because Alonso got in his face first.
That's all right.
I think Alonso went up and said, hey, what the bleep, when Ryan Jensen ran Alonso's
head
into the ground.
I thought he was talking to an official at that point, Alonso.
I did too, but we could be wrong, but go back and watch it yourself. The second time I saw it, I thought, oh, you know what he did? He went up and yelled at Harbaugh about, hey, what did Ryan Jensen just do? And Harbaugh said, oh, you want to talk about what someone just did? Here we go. And then, then it went from there.
Interesting. Real quick, Andy, what do you think of that hit?
Late slide. Unfortunate hit. I understand. The second I saw Flacco start, it was 3rd and 10, and he got to that weird, blurry area, and around 3rd and 7, I thought, this is, something has to change here. He can't keep running at this pace. Either hit the Jets or slide, and he kept running at that pace, and then he slid. So I hated to see him get hit. I don't mind if they punish Alonso, because that's the nature of the league now, and it's for the greater good. But I'm on Alonso's side on that one.
Yeah. No, I agree. I didn't think it was dirty at all. I'm glad it got penalized, but I didn't think it was dirty. I also think the slide versus dive, differentiating those two things, just get rid of them. Make it easy on the linebackers, because, if Flacco dives head first there, he's going to get a first down, and that's why Alonso can't. He's coming at full sprint. He can't let up at that point. He's trying to prevent the third down conversion. So,
yeah,
it's a dark note to end on this week. But that's all right.
Well, hope Flacco's all right too. I mean, he hasn't played great this season, but they need him. And obviously, any person you want to see them recover well from an ugly shot like that.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, obviously they have the 10 days off here, so hopefully he'll. He'll be ready to go when they go to Tennessee next week. Andy, that's a wrap for this one. Thanks, as always, to producers Shelby Royston and Lou Pellegrino, as well as editor Chris Basil, all the folks at Cadence 13 who make us sound so good. But most of all, thank you for listening to this episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. You guys really are the best. We appreciate you spending your valuable time with us. Andy and I want to hear from you, so please contact us, Andy_Benoit, GGrambling_SI on Twitter. We're both on Facebook, or you can get talkback at themmqb.com. We love hearing from you. Send suggestions, criticisms, whatever you got. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB Podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB Podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things Podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers. We will see you guys next week. They say in life there are no guarantees. Well, there might just be one exception. Husky's quality crafted, durable tools have stood the test of time for 93 years. They give their hand tools a lifetime warranty, but they are built so you won't need it. Now that's a pretty sure thing. And to Husky, that's common sense. Husky, found only at the Home Depot.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.